Well, I'm holding in my hand the book, Radical Evolution, right now. And on the cover, of course, it's got a picture of Adam and Eve and the serpent, and she's reaching for an apple. Why? We'll find out in a moment from our guest, Joel Garreau, on Coast to Coast AM. Investigative reporter and editor Joel Garreau, our guest. He's done a fine job with this book, Radical Evolution. Now, why the cover? Why Adam and Eve, Joel?
Well, you know, we're talking about all this gee whiz technology, but really what it amounts to is that we are actually taking control of our own evolution and engineering our own evolution. And it's like we're, you know, becoming the first version of these new humans that we're creating, not unlike Adam and Eve. And the question is, well, where is this taking us, you know, as a society, as a species? And when you talk to the technological elite in this country, they lay out three possibilities as to how that might work out. They lay out the heaven, the hell, and the prevail scenarios. In the heaven scenario, that's the one in which they see, you know, this curve of exponential change going straight up with inventions coming at us ever faster that, you know, allow us to regrow limbs, for example, which is actually in the lab, or dramatically extend our lifespan. Some of these guys think that if you can just stay healthy for the next 20 years, you may end up living a very, very long time because that's how fast the technology is moving.
And probably living well. You won't be some decrepit old person all hunched back and trapped in an old body, right?
Right. No, I mean, the whole point of this is not to spend the rest of your life drooling on your shoes.
That's a good way to polish them, Joel.
Right. You know, there was one of these desperate housewife babes was in People magazine just a little while ago. And they were, you know, marking the fact that, you know, here she was, this amazing babe, and she turned 40. And they were saying, you know, it didn't used to be that way. What's going on here? And they said, and she said, 40 is the new 30. And, you know, and who hasn't talked to, you know, great-grandparents who, at the age of 80, decided to, you know, go off to China to walk the Great Wall? And when you ask them what that's about, they say 80 is the new 60.
Yeah, you're right.
You know? Well, and that's with just the primitive technologies that we've got right now, and they're increasing dramatically. So, you know, you look at this and you say, well, a lot of these technologies could end up conquering pain, suffering, stupidity, ignorance, and even death. Well, you know, what's wrong with that? Sounds pretty good, right?
That sounds great. However, there's a caveat to all of this, isn't there?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, on one, this sounds like the Christian version of heaven. And it's an important scenario. It's one that has to be taken seriously because this absolutely could become one of our futures. On the other hand, it's not the only one. There are other people who look at these at this curve of exponential change, and they say, well, wait a minute. Suppose this technology gets in the hands of bumblers or fools or people who are pathological. You know, they are really worried about what they call the hell scenario. And that's one in which, you know, we could extinct the human species in the next generation. And that's the optimistic version of the hell scenario. In the pessimistic version, we wipe out all of life on Earth.
With a mistake? Is that a mistake when that happens, or was it done on purpose?
Yeah, well, I mean, it would be really a drag if it was an oops moment in the lab, you know, and all of a sudden, there we go. And actually, there was such an oops moment in Australia not too long ago. This was called the Australian mousepox incident.
What happened?
Well, Australia is one of those isolated ecosystems where, you know, they have introduced species like mice that have no natural enemies. And so from time to time, it's just mice everywhere, you know, just totally, they're totally awash in mice. So the scientists there are very interested in figuring out how to control these little buggers. And they were looking for it to create a mouse contraceptive. And instead, they created a monster. They took a virus for a disease called mousepox, and they made one genetic change in it. And all of a sudden, the new virus was 100% fatal.
Oh, my God.
It killed every mouse. And then they decided to post their work on the internet where anybody could see it. Well, this just drives the people who look at the health scenario nuts, because they're saying, well, now, wait a minute. The mouse pox doesn't hurt humans, but it's a very close relative to smallpox, which obviously does. And if you're letting any grad student with a half well-equipped bio lab see how to make this kind of alteration to produce a monster, you know, what are the odds that something is going to go terribly wrong? They call this weapons of knowledge-enabled destruction, and they're particularly worried about anything that humans can create that can make more of themselves, that can self-replicate, you know, in the fashion of computer viruses. But not only that, you know, people are talking about creating robots at the nanoscale, nanobots they're called. These could be terrific little machines. They hold out the promise, for example, of, you know, you could have millions of these swimming in your bloodstream that would be early warning indicators, for example, of cancer. And they might even be able to attack cancer cells. So they have a lot of great uses. But if you start creating those tiny robots in a fashion such that they can create more of themselves, you better know where the off switch is. Because if you don't, you have, is one of these hell scenarios, the idea that they keep replicating and replicating and replicating until they eat up all the energy on Earth. That's the gray goo scenario.
Now, somebody somewhere, Joel, may make a mistake. I mean, if all these countries are starting to do this and they're beginning to possess this kind of technology, what are the odds of something going wrong somewhere?
Well, it's obviously pretty good. The question is, you know, that lead takes us to the prevail scenario, which is the third scenario beside heaven and hell. And the guys who look at the prevail scenario say, well, you know, the problem with these first two scenarios is that they assume that our human futures and our human history is created by technology. They're saying, you know, both the heaven and the hell scenario, if they were made into summer movies, they wouldn't have a lot of plot. It would be basically the change is coming at us real fast. There's not much you can do about it. Hold on tight. The end. That would be the movie for both the heaven or the hell scenario.
And the title would be like The Nano That Ate St. Louis.
Yeah,
or something.
I mean,
it'd be
dynamite special effects, you know, but not a lot of plot. Well, the prevail scenario says, you know, that's not the way human history has worked in the past, and it's kind of depressing because it's assuming that humans can't take control of their future. And that's why the prevail scenario guys say, you know, the problem here is that these guys in the heaven and hell scenarios are measuring change by how many transistors you can get to talk to each other in this curve of change. And that, in fact, you know, what's happened in the past when we managed to muddle through is that the critical element is how many inventive humans we managed to connect, not how many transistors. Prevail is kind of a bet on human cussedness. It's a bet on our ability to throw the curve a curve. I mean, think, for example, in World War II of the British nation of shopkeepers who prevailed against the Third Reich. That wasn't supposed to happen, you know? That wasn't supposed to be how that movie ended.
That was unplanned.
And yet it did. So that's the prevail scenario. And there's some reasons for guarded optimism about this prevail scenario. I mean, think, for example, back to 9/11. The fourth plane never made it to its target. Why? Because the Air Force was so quick on the trigger? No. Because the White House was so smart? No. What happened was that the people on board that fourth aircraft, using their onboard phone technology, were able, inside of an hour, to figure out, diagnose, and cure their society's ills and, you know, the ultimate expense to themselves. It's that kind of a bottom-up solution to our problems that gives me guarded hope for the future. It's what some people call coevolution. It's the notion that, you know, no matter how many challenges we have coming at us, the question is, can we create solutions almost as fast as the challenges come at us?
Don't you think, Joel, because some people will say that we aren't supposed to advance this way, that we are playing with God, we're playing with Mother Nature. I though, think that if God didn't want us to succeed this way, we wouldn't have that kind of knowledge. It wouldn't be allowed. We wouldn't grow. I think we're supposed to do this. I think this is part of what living is all about in this universe, and that's to achieve this oneness with whatever's out there. And this is probably one way of doing it.
Yeah, I got a hunch you're right. What we are talking about doing here is, you know, leaving far behind the kind of evolution that we talk about with Darwin. And it's even going to be happening faster than cultural evolution, which started 8,000 years ago when we were able to start sharing our ideas with the written word. Now it's happening so fast because of our technologies that, you know, we're heading into a situation where we are dramatically changing what it means to be human. And I think, you know, what you say is right, that this could be the ultimate final exam. You know, it could be that every species gets to this stage where they start taking control of their own evolution and start directing, you know, what it is their species is going to be about for the first time. And, you know, as of yet, we haven't managed to establish contact with any other intelligence in the universe. So the question is, well, maybe everybody else flunked this exam.
Well, like you were saying in the beginning of the program, some of this nanotechnology, which is lighter than plastic, stronger than just about anything that you can find on this planet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see cars being made with this, maybe missiles, oh, yeah. maybe rockets. We won't have to have the problem that we've had with the space shuttle, with tiles falling off. The entire shuttle could be made with some kind of nanomaterial that, resists heat on reentry. I think the applications are huge.
I mean, NASA sees it as being far more dramatic than that. I mean, forget about chemical rockets and forget about shuttles. I mean, what they're interested in is taking this nanomaterial and, I mean, with this kind of strength and light weight, believe it or not, NASA is talking about drawing a line of this stuff 22,000 miles from the surface of the Earth up into geosynchronous orbit. And if you had a cable that long, believe it or not, you'd have a space elevator, which with a fraction of the energy, you know, you'd be able to come up and back, and that this would actually finally allow humans to get to the stars in ways that you're just never going to do with these chemical rockets.
You could actually send up there rockets that you want to launch, let's say, to the moon or Mars, without launching them to fight Earth's gravity.
Right.
You just hoist them up the elevator, right?
Get out of the gravity well.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that's all pretty speculative right now, and you know, I'm trying to keep this. You know, I'm trying to convince people that I'm not talking about science fiction here. That, you know, that this is really serious. That we're talking, you know, that these changes are in the near term, and that they're going to affect you and your kids. But as you say, the speculative aspects of this are really mind-boggling.
What would Leonardo da Vinci have done had he been able to see the vision way into the future like this?
Well, it's a lot like Galileo, you know. Galileo, the big deal was not paired lenses. It was not about telescopes. It was about, you know, that what his discovery that the Earth circled around the sun, it completely changed humans' attitudes about who they were and what their relationship was to the rest of the universe. You know, maybe we're not at the center of the universe. Maybe we're just circling an unfashionable star in a tacky neighborhood in the galaxy. Similarly, you know, this technology that I'm talking about, it's not about how fast the computers can go any more than 500 years ago it was about telescopes. Now we're talking about actually taking control of evolution into our own hands and creating a radical evolution and a dramatic change in who we are and doing it in the next 20 years. That's as dramatic as Galileo.
Can it have a bad ending, Joel? What could go wrong?
Oh, yeah. Could we screw this up? Absolutely. In fact, I mean, we had a really bad 20th century. The hell scenario is the easiest sell in the world. If you say to somebody, you know, this could really go bad. People will just shake their head and say, yep, you're right, we're doomed. Well, you know, what's funny about that is that people buy that health scenario despite the fact that, you know, we're better fed and better off than any generation in history, and we're living in one of the least likely scenarios that you could have imagined 50 years ago. We haven't popped a nuclear weapon in anger, you know, since 1945. It wasn't, and back in the 50s, you couldn't have gotten a plug nickel for that scenario of this future. Nobody would believe that that would be happening in 2005. And yet it did. You know, why? Because we managed to come up with solutions almost as fast as we created challenges. You know, think, for example, to an example back to the Dark Ages. You look at all the challenges that were facing humans back in the Dark Ages, and you say, you know, this, we're cooked. This, we're just never going to make it past plague and devastation and famine, war, pestilence. And then what happened was the printing press. And all of a sudden, we could share and store our ideas in ways that had never been possible before. What results? Well, you end up with solutions that were beyond the imagination of any one human or any one country. Things like global trade, and the Enlightenment, which led to the rise of democracy, and the science itself. Look back to the 1970s, you know, and suppose back in the 1970s, somebody had told you that in the year 2005, every minute of every hour, the most incredibly virulent viruses and worms that you could imagine would be attacking our most sensitive computers day after day after day. Well, back in the 70s, you would have thought, well, we're toast, you know, we're cooked.
First of all, I would have said, what's a computer?
Well,
back in
right.
the 70s. Though,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, it would have seemed hopelessly Pollyannish to think that the countermeasures would have evolved almost as fast as the challenges. And yet that's exactly the world that we're living in today, in which these viruses and worms, so far anyway, are largely a nuisance, not a disaster. Now, this could all change tomorrow. I mean, I don't mean to sound like too much of a optimistic idiot. I mean, I do mean to say that the health scenario should be taken extremely seriously, because that's the way we're going to avoid it, is by realizing, you know, what we're up against. But I'm saying it's not inevitable.
And I think the change is welcome. Isn't it time for humans to take that next step?
Well, I think we're going to. Now, whether we should or not, there are people who give you an argument about that. In Washington, there are people who describe themselves as bioconservatives, and they get a lot of attention in the White House. And these are people who are saying, well, that the idea of changing what it means to be human is nuts. They say, now, wait a minute, you know, isn't, you know, our most cherished institutions, like the Constitution, you know, isn't that based on our current understanding of what it means to be human? You know, the whole notion is based on all men are created equal. Well, suppose that's no longer the case. Does that end up destroying the institutions that we've come to love? You know, and it's no small deal changing the fundamentals of what it means to be human. They're right. I mean, they're asking very, very good questions. I wish somebody was asking questions this smart back when nuclear power was first being offered to us. The problem
yet they're going to build more.
Yeah, well, the problem is that you then ask, you know, you ask these guys, okay, well, great, okay, that's really interesting what you say. So what do you suggest we do about it? And they don't have a lot of answers. You know, the best one of the Francis Fukuyama, who's a very smart guy, says maybe what we should do is create a regulatory state that reaches deep into the workings of India, Japan, China, South Korea, Europe, and the United States, and regulates all of science and all of innovation.
Well, that could happen. Joel, stay with us. We'll be back with you in a moment. We'll talk about where you can get your book, talk about your website, and also how about those stock tips now of nanotechnology. The next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for our guest, Joel Gureau. But for now, a few more questions. How about some stock tips as well? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Joel, let's talk a little bit about nanotechnology and also some stock tips, companies that are in this field. First of all, explain to us what these nanos are, actually.
Well, nanotechnology refers to the extremely small, something that's a billionth of a meter. It's the size of a molecule or an atom. And when you can start manipulating matter at that level of precision, you're talking about taking control of matter and energy itself. And that's kind of a breathtaking idea. I mean, you're really taking on some of the powers of that historically had been associated with the gods in ancient myth, if you can do that. And in fact, there's already tons of nanomaterial that's been created in the United States. And this whole sector is expected to be the size of the GNP of Canada by 2015. You know, it'll change how we do medicine, how we do energy, how we do war, how we do peace. It has amazing possibilities. It also has amazing, you know, potentials for abuse. But this is, you know, this basically is now where biotech was 20 years ago. And so, I mean, I would not, I'm not an investment advisor. I'm a reporter. What do I know? You know, if I were rich, I wouldn't have to write books. So don't listen to me for your stock tips. But in the broad sense, you know, you are looking at, you know, somebody in there is going to be the next Microsoft. That's a safe bet. And, you know, one of the things that has occurred to me is that, for example, I was thinking about for my daughter, who's 20 and who's going to be out of college soon, you know, you look at these, as they say, these near-term pharmaceuticals, not as sexy as nanotechnology, but nonetheless pretty amazing implications, like these memory drugs. I thought about seeing if I could invest in all five of the companies that are, you know, right now racing to bring this online in the next 3 years and invest in the entire sector, rather than trying to guess which one was going to get to the finish line first.
Good point. Is there like a nanotechnology fund out there that dabbles just in that area, rather than these individual pickings of companies?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, it's really, really primitive at this stage. As I say, people have been, I mean, be careful what you tell people about investing their hard-earned money. People have been losing money in biotechnology now for 20 years. I mean, it hasn't paid off. It's taken a while for this to become profitable, even though, you know, what they're creating is mind-boggling. And you have, the potential for stem cells and so many other miracles that are coming online just in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years. But there's a difference between creating these miracles and creating a profitable company to invest in.
Right, but they are attracting venture capital.
Our listeners, you know, off on a wild goose chase to start investing in nanotech. I think that's pretty premature.
And putting their whole life savings in it.
Yeah, right.
That wouldn't work.
Yeah.
That would. But what companies are you bullish on in terms of the knowledge of biotechnology? If they hit, great, but who's out there? Who are the players, at least?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I say, in the very near term, the thing that I'm most interested in, I think, has got a great market, is these memory drugs. And the five companies that are competing are all listed in Radical Evolution. They're all named. And
all the big boys?
No, actually, they're small companies. You don't tend to get the real innovation from, you know, the big names like Genentech and like that. These are all startups. This is in order to really make money in the stock market, the object of the game is to pick the next Microsoft or the next Intel, you know, the next Amazon. And that's the great parlor game, is trying to figure out who that's going to be. And the first thing you got to do if you're going to play that kind of extremely risky game that I don't advise, that you put all of your life savings in, don't tell me, don't lose all your money and then come back to me. Don't take my word for it. But if you were to look up in the Index of Radical Evolution with the companies that are involved in the stage two clinical trials of the memory drugs, if you were looking to make extremely risky investments, that might be fun to do.
And stage three gets you where? Out of the FDA or to the FDA?
No, stage three gets you to that. Stage three is the one that demonstrates that not only is it safe, but it's effective. In other words, it works. So they're already up past safe. It hasn't killed anybody. Now what they're trying to do is demonstrate that it does, in fact, dramatically change your mental functions. And if that, and they've been successful in their tests so far, but of course that's no guarantee. I mean, look at Vioxx and things like this. There, I mean, a lot of these technologies, are these technologies going to bite us in the butt? Of course some of them are. I mean, that's our entire history with these things. But, this new technology is going in interesting directions. The reason that drugs right now have side effects is that they're created like industrial age substances. You create, millions of exactly the same pill, despite the fact that you know that every human being has got a slightly different metabolism. So when that happens, of course you have to expect that some of these identical pills are not going to react well in some portion of the human population, and that's what we call side effects. But because of this curve of change and because of what we're able to do now, you're looking increasingly at manufacturing anything you want to a market of one. I mean, think today of the iPod. There's no two iPods that are the same. The real value of an iPod is not that little piece of plastic hanging around your neck. It's what you put in it.
That's right.
None of that is the same. Well, what we're looking at in the very near future is being able to get to the point where you can sequence your own genetic material so that you know exactly what, your own genome is like. And that's, in the near future going to be coming down to on the order of $1,000 for anybody who wants it. Well, once you've got that, then you're able to target, exactly your metabolism, exactly your illness. And when you're doing that, when you're customizing for a unit of one, well, by definition, it's hard to imagine exactly how you're going to get side effects since it's aimed directly at you.
Are you bullish on any specific companies, not the memory drug ones, but pure nanotechnology companies that are working on that?
Too early.
It is.
Too early. I wouldn't recommend it. It would be hugely irresponsible for me. I just don't think.
Good for you. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah.
Are some of them publicly held, though, or are they still private?
Well, this is really, what you're seeing is that an awful lot of major companies that are in the race for nanotechnology, I mean, DuPont, Kodak, General Electric, I mean, an awful lot of the majors are seeing this as, the next frontier, and they're all racing. And this is it's not just the United States thing. All of these technologies there. I mean, you're seeing great breakthroughs in Asia. Take genetics, for example. The first licensed medical intervention using genetics did not come out of the United States. It came out of China. And the first cloned human embryo did not come out of the United States. It came out of South Korea. And a lot of people in Asia don't have the same ethical setup that you might find in red state America, for example. So, the idea of stem cells is not anywhere near as controversial in other parts of the world as we might find it here. Now, I'm not saying that the controversies are a bad thing. I'm glad we're asking these questions. Do embryos, should they be respected as potential human life and messing around with them banned? I'm glad we're asking questions like that. I mean, because I think the way we're going to get into this future successfully is to try everything and find out what works as quickly as we can. And so, you know, the more visions of this from India and China, I've been engaging with Radical Evolution. I've been doing my best to engage people of faith, who are evangelicals. And that can be an uphill struggle sometimes because a lot of these people are allergic to the word evolution that's in the title of my book. You know, but what I say is, hey, look, let's not argue about what happened over the last 100,000 years, okay? Let's just set that aside for a minute. Let's look at what's happening to our kids in the next 20 years in our own engineered evolution. And once I do that, you know, I find that I'm talking to an awful lot of thoughtful people who are asking good and important questions.
This radical evolution, when did it start?
The easiest way to put in the marker on it, I think, is when you're starting talking about computers on your desk that had the power only corporations could have had only 20 years ago. I mean, I think when you're starting to talk about having that kind of power available to all sorts of people, you can really see how you're changing the world in a lot of important ways. I mean, take the cell phone, for example, which has got now more computer. That's the real personal computer of the early 21st century. And, you know, that's changing even the developed world in ways that were unimaginable. In the Philippines, in the year 2000, for example, they had this terrible tyrant, Joseph Estrada, who was really ruining the country. And people in the Philippines, there were so many cell phones and so many people using text messaging where they could send, you know, print messages to each other.
Sure, back and forth. I've done that.
Sure. Well, they were able to bring hundreds of thousands of people into the street just by relaying text messages in half an hour. And, you know, this was a political movement that they had never been seen before. It reminds me of the importance of shortwave technology to the French Resistance or Xerox machines to the Solidarity Resistance or fax machines to the Tiananmen Square. These technologies always have impacts on human organization and on politics.
There you have it. There's your next presidential campaign.
Everybody, that's right.
Tells a friend. Text a friend right now, vote for me, that kind of thing.
Well, not only that, but it's changing our very ideas of what politics mean. You know, right now we have this kind of strange idea that politics means left versus right. Well, that's kind of an industrial age idea, dividing the whole world into who's got and who doesn't. But when you start looking at the world, you realize, you know, that's not the way people are organized anymore. You look at people who are against genetically modified food, for example, and you'll probably find that the same person thinks it would be a great idea to pay for stem cell research in order to help their grandparents with Alzheimer's. You know, you end up with people from on the political right, like Leon Cass of the President's Council on Bioethics. And he wants to bring all of this technology to a screeching halt. And he's in the same boat with people like Greenpeace or the people who are, you know, against the World Bank or Christians who, you know, are skeptical about Darwin are right in the same boat with the Boston Women's Health Collective and Prince Charles. And talk about strange bedfellows. You know, the distinction is increasingly between people who see stuff to fear and people who see stuff as opportunity. I think that's the new political divide that's replacing our industrial age idea of what's left and what's right.
Stuart Brand, who wrote a little bit of praise for your book, Radical Evolution, says, how weird, how soon? Now, in reading the book, I didn't find it to be weird. I don't think the subject matter is weird. Do you?
Well, no, obviously not. But I tell you, you know, I'm not writing for the technological elite. I'm not writing for the people who subscribe to Wired
magazine.
You're writing
for us.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the reason I've been typing as fast as I can is to get this out of the halls of the intellectual elite and, you know, out into people like us. So, I mean, I have a lot more confidence in, you know, in the general public than I do in any elite. The famous line was, I'd rather be ruled by the first 1,000 names in the New York phone book than by the entire faculty of Harvard. Well, I certainly agree with that. And, you know, I think that, you know, if we're going to get through this next 20 years intact, it's because we are going to be coming up with solutions at least as fast as we're coming up with challenges. And I think we're going to be doing it in a bottom-up way, not waiting for our leaders. I mean, take eBay, for example. You look at that, and, you know, on one level, that's just the world's largest flea market. But on another level, what you're looking at is tens of millions of people worldwide who are creating extremely complex behavior, you know, without any leaders, in a bottom-up way that's changing the changing economies and changing commerce.
Dramatically. eBay has become the garage sale of the Internet.
Yes.
And, you know, it is just, it's incredible how ideas grow like that. Mm-hmm. And generate revenue. I mean, billions of dollars of revenue now, probably.
Yeah.
And you wonder,
it's changing retail. I mean, it's not just your garage sale mom and pops anymore. Increasingly, you're finding big name companies who are deciding that this is the way, you know, that this is the future of all of commerce.
They don't have any overhead anymore. They don't have to pay for the lease of this building.
Sure.
And stock all this inventory. You know, they get an order, they process it, they probably buy their inventory the moment they get their order. That's why a lot of places you don't get shipped right away. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, what a great, brilliant way. All you got to do, though, is get the word out.
Yeah, I mean, this is already changing cities, for example. You know, there are 87 classes of buildings that make up cities, according to the head of architecture at MIT. And he's saying that these advances are changing all of them. I mean, the most familiar example might be something like bookstores. You know, I mean, think of, you know, Amazon, think of the dent that Amazon has put into bookstores. An awful lot of small and, you know, weakly managed ones have disappeared.
But you know what? The big ones have had to adjust, Joel, and what they've done is they've become coffee shops with books. They've become a place to go. I know a person who goes in there, and she'll spend 6 hours in a bookstore.
Sure.
Just,
I mean,
reading.
What's changed is that the most important part of that building is no longer the books. It's the couches and the cappuccino machines.
Exactly.
I mean, what it means is that we're putting an incredible premium on face-to-face contact between humans. And, you know, basically this bookstore is now a place for face-to-face contact that also sells books. I think you're going to be seeing more and more of that as it rolls out to all sorts of retail. You're going to see it in the mall. I have a friend named Jaron Lanier, who was one of the founders of Virtual Reality. And he says that the way that you're going to know that the shopping center has become primarily a place for face-to-face contact and entertainment is that the first thing that's going to disappear is the escalators to be replaced by rides. The first time you take a Ferris wheel up to the third floor of the mall, remember Jaron, because he called that first.
Great idea. Stay with us. We're going to take phone calls next with our guest, Joel Garreau, right here on Coast to Coast AM. You've heard what we've been talking about. Now it's your turn.